stop the signal.
All right, guys, welcome to, after a little quick false start, welcome to another episode of The Signal. This is going to be a really fun episode. This is going to be a little bit of an extension of an episode that I recorded with Lee on his program probably 2 or 3 weeks ago regarding decision-making and particularly as it applied to COVID. I've brought another guest on along with Lee, Stateless Med, who you may have heard me mention multiple times through multiple episodes over particularly the last year, year and a half. He was one of the primary resources that was telling me actual medical stuff in my DMs as I was trying to figure out COVID and, or as we were all trying to cobble together what was going on with COVID. And he was an invaluable resource. So I think you all know Lee. Lee probably needs no introduction, but Stateless Med, you want to give us a little bit of background on you, why you're perhaps qualified to speak to this, without giving too much detail.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited for this conversation because I really enjoyed the conversation you and Lee had. I'm an emergency physician out in California, the bastion of insanity that is our state that's burning to the ground. And so, yeah, I had a firsthand view of kind of from the beginning, both the start of the pandemic and the outbreak, and then also watching the first lockdowns really hit outside of New York.
Great. So I think to kick this off, people have heard me and Lee blather on about this for, you know, across multiple platforms and multiple episodes. So I really want to get your view. And we can start really generally, but I'm curious about, so when I was doing that, when I was cobbling together that little article that I wrote, and then I turned it into an episode, one of the things that I had noticed was that the first, and forgive me for the exact dates, but because I haven't gone back in a little while, but I think the first recorded COVID case in the United States was from that plane that came over to Seattle. There were 2 or 3 positive tests from that plane. That was January 20th, 21st, thereabouts of 2020. And just as to take everyone back, the worry began to grow between January and March about this. But the, in my opinion, the federal government seemed to flip-flop. Of course, well, I'll only speak for myself, but I did not see any of the intensity of like lockdowns and canceling sports and all that. Like I did not see that coming. But so, you know, first positive case, January 20th, we had been hearing about it rumbling around China for a while before that, a few months. And then 2 months later, March 20th, we were in lockdown, if I remember correctly. So the first thing that I want to open this up with, Stateless Med, if you don't mind, would be to pick your brain about what was going on front lines, quote unquote, in the medical field during that time, or you can even take it back before January 20th if there are items of interest prior.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing was that we were all pretty aware of the existence of COVID, but we were watching what was happening primarily in Italy. Of course, we were seeing what was happening in China, but there was so little information coming out of China that it really wasn't useful. And then we were seeing Italy go into lockdown and kind of their elderly population just get decimated and their hospitals, which are, you know, their hospital system is kind of stretched at baseline. And so to watch it get overwhelmed was kind of what we were seeing. And then when it showed up here, I think everyone was just kind of like maybe a bit unprepared for what a real pandemic looks like in the United States and from our healthcare system. And so we were terrified that what happened in Italy was going to happen in the US. And I think that partially explains that initial response period. You know, I give everyone kind of a pass for the first month because no one knew what was going on. And we were still at the time really blind because we couldn't test for it. Like in order to get a test, you had to call a few people and then send a sample to the CDC. Like there was no ability to test for it.
Absolutely. And to add to that, I actually do too. As much as I was pissed off, like starting in, well, I mean, really starting in March, I absolutely give a pass because there was so little information. If everybody remembers even getting tested, I mean, how many tests had been administered by April 1st? I mean, none. I mean, statistically speaking, none. We had no grasp of the animal, and for sure, Italy, particularly in the northern parts of Italy, got hit hard. And I think the hospitals filled up, so they had no room to treat people. Even people that were otherwise with correct treatment would have been absolutely fine. You know, they just weren't getting to the hospital, and they were dying outside of the hospital, or that's what it looked like. So, to be clear, I absolutely give a pass early, especially to ground, like, you know, non-politician, like on the ground people, you know, there just wasn't any information. So anyway, pick it up from there.
Yeah. I think the other interesting thing, about COVID and what we're seeing particularly early on is that it really doesn't look like anything else that I've at least seen. I mean, I'm still relatively early in my career, but COVID is this unique thing where people will show up and might look relatively well, but their oxygen levels will be crazy low. And then over the course of the next 24 to 48 hours, they might just rapidly decompensate and end up on a ventilator. And then they'll end up on a ventilator for 20, 30 days, which is also very uncommon. And so that combination really fills up your ICU, which, you know, from the health system side, it was like from a healthcare provider side, it was really frustrating to see some of these people go to the emergency departments and be like, these places are empty. But what they don't realize is that the ICUs where all the sickest people are full. And, you know, from the standpoint of really sick people coming in, if we're going to get overwhelmed, it's going to be the ICUs that get filled first. And so the rest of the hospital might look empty, but you might not have the resources to actually treat more critically ill people.
Without jumping too far forward, just because it was mentioned, can you take me through the prevailing thought? Because this is something that I don't have a grasp of. I mean, except for what I think I've gleaned from the news, maybe the news, I guess. But what was the prevailing thought on ventilators, and what is it now? Did it change? What was going on there? Because I know that there was a lot of really sketchy, like InfoWars style stuff, like where they were like, oh, people shouldn't be administering the ventilator. And who knows if that was true, but it does seem like it may have been over administered. Certainly it was over ordered because they had thousands of them sitting in warehouses and things, you know. What from your perspective, can you take us through anything that was going on there?
Yeah, it 100% changed. Very early, we were told to put people on ventilators early if they were critically ill. And that proved to be 100% wrong. Because the longer you, if you can keep someone off a ventilator, then their survival goes way up. Sometimes you have no choice and you just have to do it because there's no other way to provide oxygen.
To jump in real quick, sorry. When you say that their odds of survival go way up through avoiding a ventilator, is that in medicine in general or is that just specific to like a COVID type infection?
So it's specific to a COVID-like infection or other diseases that cause inflammation in the lungs. So the pressure that you provide externally from a ventilator actually can cause stress on the smallest airways in the lungs because they're used to experiencing negative pressure pulling the air in, whereas the ventilator pushes positive pressure into the lung. And so you get what's called barotrauma. So you get this pressure trauma to the small airways. And so when there's already inflammation going on, you can actually cause more harm.
Okay. Makes sense.
Okay. Continue if there is, over the course of time, it was realized that this was not, optimal for this type of disease or
Yeah. I mean, this is a recurring theme in COVID and medicine, is we say these things with a lot of certainty. And then 2 months later, we find out that we were 100% wrong. Same thing happened with COVID and steroids. So there are certain kinds of anti-inflammatory medications that they thought increased death rates, but turns out that they're actually probably one of the better treatments for it. If you have to get admitted to the hospital. So, you know, it's a recurring theme in medicine, which is why I get so frustrated with all these dogmatic people saying trust science, or all these doctors.
Yeah.
I'm a doctor, listen to me. And it's like, well, you know, the medical field's been wrong a lot. So a little bit of humility would be kind of nice.
Right. And that's why, and to take it back to last year, that's why I absolutely love DMing with you. Was because you clearly had the knowledge and were clearly like looking for a solution and not necessarily dogmatic, because I just don't know. Obviously, you know, I don't know. I can look at data. I don't have that on the ground experience. And that was just invaluable. And it sounds like cooler heads prevailed at some point, because it seems as though they backed off on applying ventilators very early in the process, you know, by, I don't know, June, July, it's tough to remember, but the death rates seem to decline, not only from probably some existing immunity from existing infections, but maybe from learning. I mean, the natural process of learning, like that's got to be the most frustrating thing for you, is like, as we go through what is unknown, we learn, and you have to be able to adapt. And that's what probably the most frustrating thing is. I won't put words in your mouth, but that would be the most frustrating thing to me about mixing politics in, is that it's like, yes, like it's process, it not process of elimination, that makes it sound like a crapshoot, but like you learn as you go. And mixing politics in it, it was like they were just dogmatically, repeating the same things over and over again. You're like, dude, it's all right to be wrong, like, you know, a little bit,
yeah.
Like, as long as you're learning from it. So that was maddening. So, but it sounds like when do you think that things were kind of shaping up in terms of their ventilator use and maybe more appropriate treatments, or what did that learning curve look like?
So I, from the ventilator side, I think we kind of learned in the first month or two of the big outbreaks in the US that the ventilators aren't the best option. And then the rest of it's just been kind of a slow trickle of actual studies looking at these different treatments. I mean, the prototypical example of what you were talking about is the response to like hydroxychloroquine as a treatment. It's like the second Trump recommends it, he's automatically like thrown out. But he wasn't wrong at the time that there was some like limited data to suggest that it could be beneficial. Now, mm-hmm. like the good studies hadn't been done, and when they got done, it looked like it didn't work. But it wasn't like he was throwing out this incredibly dangerous option, and one that had no evidence behind it. So like, it was really frustrating to see that. And it happened in the medical field too. It's not just outside medicine that people were doing that. Like, people that I know that I work with, like, got really uptight about studying hydroxychloroquine as a potential treatment.
Because of the political aspect?
Yeah, because okay. Trump recommended it. And wow. I live in a liberal bastion, and so anything Trump recommends is automatically bad. And that filters through everything, including medicine, which is, once again, very frustrating.
Sure. So, Lee, we were talking about, not just in that episode, but I mean, I think more broadly speaking, my show is kind of about separating signal from noise. What I'd like to get into, like, what were your thoughts, like, as we moved through this? I assume that at some point, I mean, because we were DMing, so I knew that we were roughly on the same page, and I knew that was not that page. We were reading off a little bit of a different hymnal than maybe some other people. Can you take me through some of your decision making and some of maybe how that played in your field? And then I'd like to kind of bounce that off Lee a little bit too, just to get his input on where, like how we were all kind of rattling, you know, through March and April, we were all kind of rattling off the you know, it was kind of like bowling where we were just bouncing off the gutters until I feel like we all kind of settled on something fairly accurate. But what did that look like for you? And definitely in contrast or in comparison to the rest of the people that you worked with or in your field?
I think the biggest thing was just not being scared of it. Because like when it first showed up, like you were talking about with Lee about case fatality rates versus like infection fatality rates. Mm-hmm. We had so few diagnosed cases. They were all sick people in the ICU that were getting actually diagnosed that it looked like the initial rates were like 5 to 10%.
Right. Which... And not to butt in, but like, that's like that I, and both you, I know because I was beating you up in the DMs about this, but like, from a data standpoint, I was just freaking the hell out because like, that's such an insane metric. Like anybody that's sick enough to be in the hospital was getting tested. So it was like your survival rates looked insane. Anyway, continue. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. That's a perfect example of this thing in medical research that we talk about called confounding by indication, where like, only the sickest people get a specific treatment or only the sickest people get a specific test. So it looks like this treatment kills people or this like this thing has a really high mortality rate, but it's because of the baseline characteristics of the group that you're looking at. Like a historical example of that was that there was a epidemiologic study that showed that drinking coffee caused lung cancer. But what was really going on was that people were drinking coffee and having their morning cigarette.
Having the morning cigarette, right? Yeah, sure.
And so they didn't look at the second level effect and that confounding. And so, you know, that's a recurrent theme in medicine and medical research. And it's something that you really want to look out for when you start hearing these new, like doomsday scenarios about the new thing that causes cancer, the new thing that's going to kill you. Like you got to look at the group that the study they're quoting was using to see if it's actually a representative sample. And for, at least for me, once we got a couple months in and right around the time that you wrote that Medium article, that was around the time that I was feeling a lot better. I was not as scared of it. I knew that if we had a big outbreak in our community, that it would put a lot of strain on the hospital and it wouldn't be fun working. But at the same time, I wasn't worried that I was going to get like critically ill. There were still plenty of people that I work with that were terrified of it, like young, healthy 30 somethings that despite all the data had bought into the fear porn that was CNN, that anyone who gets COVID is going to die. And like, they were all terrified of it. And it was really fascinating to watch from my point of view, to see all these people that I know are smart, really, really good doctors, but then just hook, line and sinker buying the fear porn.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that was, that was a fairly common thing, but I mean, again, as much as you got to put yourself back in that time. And I mean, they were really, pumping that hard. I mean, Lee, you and I were, you know, like I said, talking about it and there was a lot of noise, right? I mean, there still is a lot of noise. They are pumping this thing hard. And, you know, that if you don't see the state as we do, it's very easy to buy in because you kind of forget like that's kind of the difference between the way that we approach, at least things that are being preached by the media and stuff like that. And the way that a lot of people do is that, they look at them kind of like a referee and we look at them very suspiciously. And so it's very easy, like it. In some ways it was a little bit of, I don't want to say a layup because it definitely wasn't a layup, but like it was easier to approach this from a very suspicious angle, you know, as it turned out, because it stunk, you know, to Denmark. But you forget that a lot of people do kind of think of the state and the media as a little bit of a referee. But do we have anything more to I do want to get into future stuff, but do you have anything that you remember that we really want to touch base on? Because I feel really, it's just great to have somebody that was in the medical field at that time and can right. give some on the ground. Do you have anything that strikes your fancy?
Wait. One of the things that, you know, struck me was the difference between the way this was presented by the media. Like you said, it was pretty much instantaneous, like full on panic mode. You know, the sky is falling, all this kind of thing. Versus like what we were seeing from a lot of like inconsistency from like the workers in the healthcare profession. So like pretty much every news anchor was like, you know, this is terrible. You know, the wheels are coming off, everybody's going to die. And then if you went on, you know, Instagram or Twitter or whatever, you had, you know, a handful of physicians saying like, hey, this is going to be really bad. And you had like thousands of videos of, you know, like nurses dancing and that whole cliche. You know, what was your, like, as a physician, I mean, you know, put yourself in a position to speak for the practice, the industry, the discipline as a whole, I guess. Like, how, other than the very obvious, like, how could that have been handled better, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I've said a bunch of times that no group of people wasted, like, global societal goodwill more than the healthcare community did during the initial months of COVID. Because, like, everyone was calling us heroes. Like, Starbucks would give anyone that worked at a hospital free coffee. Like, everyone was really like, we're all in this together. We recognize that if you're working in a place like the emergency department, that you're exposing yourself to risk that you may not have realized was going to exist like a year ago. And then all these stupid videos started showing up. Of, you know, and I understand that like the impulse is it's stressful and it's a way to blow off stress. But you don't have to post them on TikTok, right? You can make a video and just send it around to your friends and not post it on TikTok. And that destroyed goodwill. It was really kind of disappointing to see people that, that should know better. Like, well, they should know better.
Yeah, it seemed very tone deaf. Like, you know, I mean, there, you know, obviously there were people that died from this. And, you know, so like while these videos are coming out every day, there were people dying with, you know, no clear, you know, course of action to prevent it. There's people who can't have funerals, can't go see their family members in the hospital. You know, and this stuff is coming out. And I know that definitely affected my perception of like how serious could it be? You know what I mean? Like if you turn on CNN and you see, you know, Brian Stelter or whatever his name is, you know, on the brink of tears because it's the apocalypse. And then, you know, you open your phone and there's a bunch of people dancing around, you know, like a synchronized dance, you know, at the hospital where supposedly the apocalypse is happening. For me, it created a situation where it's like, well, you know, I'm interpreting this as low quality data. Like one of these parties is, or both are giving me low quality information. Like, you know, and so I don't have a real reason to make a fundamental change to my day-to-day lifestyle in terms of PPE or, you know, social distancing or things like that. You know what I mean? Like that was one of the factors that led me basically to just go with a business as usual plan, you know, and obviously, you know, I wore a mask if like, you know, you had to or that kind of thing, but I wasn't, in, you know, I'm in Florida. I'm not in a lockdown state. I mean, I don't know. I mean, do you feel like that would have saved any lives if those videos had not come out? I mean, would more people have taken this seriously?
No, I think that, if the medical community was willing to do a legitimate postmortem of this, which I don't think they will, because just like politicians, it's not in their self-interest to really dig down and look at all the big mistakes that were made.
Sure.
But I think that one of the things about COVID is that there's really not a whole lot that you can do, to prevent it from spreading. Some people are going to just be essentially super spreaders with really high viral counts that if they're around other people, they're going to have a high likelihood of spreading it. And a ton of other people won't be. And locking people in their homes just means that they're going to spread it in their homes if they're a super spreader. Not to say that being careful and not going to concerts at small venues where 200 people are packed together and spreading it amongst yourselves wasn't a good idea for people to avoid. But at the same time, like you were saying, like we had this weird, like visual dichotomy of people dying alone because their family members weren't allowed to go visit them, which is to me, one of the most immoral things that the healthcare system did to people, was to make people die alone. No one should have to do that. And I think that at least in part might explain the continued fear that people have of COVID, because deep down people are afraid of death, and probably just as much they're afraid of dying alone. And COVID made people die alone because the healthcare system decided that visitors weren't allowed in the hospital, and especially in cases where a patient had COVID. And I hope that never happens again. I don't have the best, I don't have a whole lot of hope that it would happen again in another pandemic, but like, I really do think that is probably the biggest reason why we still see this large degree of fear in all these people, is that, you know, deep down they're so scared of getting it and then dying alone. And then you contrast that to fancy like TikTok videos where people are putting exercise balls like to make themselves have a big butt and dancing around in PPE that is supposedly the gold of the medical profession at the time, but they're dancing around wearing all this PPE. And it just really destroyed any potential messaging that they could have had out there to say that this is a really serious bad disease, particularly for elderly people or people who have like diabetes, hypertension, or are overweight. Like it really is a really bad disease for those people.
By the numbers, it really is. I mean, that is no joke. I mean, if you really look, if you dig into the numbers, my God, man. I mean, it's crazy how quickly the mortality rate ramps up late in age, and particularly with those types of, I don't know if you would call it a comorbidity, but those types of conditions. Like it is pretty wild. One question that I have as well, speaking of, you know, Lee being in Florida, I'm in Texas, and I can't remember if you have revealed where you are in this episode, but
yeah, regardless. California.
Okay, California. Yeah. What is your take on, so, and I think I said this on the, you know, in my article and on the episode that I made, or at least in passing since, is that, you know, I had a number of friends, or have a number of friends who are nurses here, and I actually had one get laid off because he wasn't getting hours during COVID, because they had, you know, locked everything down, so people weren't getting in car wrecks and yada yada yada, and we just didn't seem to get it that bad here, and I don't think Florida got it that bad. I mean, infections, yes, but the seriousness of it in terms of overrunning hospitals was not that bad. What is your was what is your take on that in terms of, was that a climate thing? Was that a, the way that it was approached thing? Because it's tough to have a control group because all of the Gulf states seem to have taken a more lax approach. Maybe except for, I think, what was it, Alabama or Mississippi? One of them took a more strict approach, but by and large, the approaches to the disease did kind of follow geographic and therefore political boundaries. But they, that also coincides with a, you know, warm weather, which is, you know, a respiratory disease killer. I mean, at least with regards to the flu, you know, I mean, it just doesn't affect people as badly. Could you offer any insight on that, or your thoughts on that? Like, is that, was the approach in certain areas, like let's say Queens or Seattle or LA or whatever, was it entirely approach based? Was it climate based? Was it what was causing these hot spots and what was causing these relative cold spots? Because where I'm at in Fort Worth, our hospitals emptied out. And I don't even know of anybody. I had one friend that got sick, like, I don't know, 6 months ago, maybe, you know, he was sick for like a day. And that's been about it.
Yeah. I think one of the predictors of having bad outbreaks, at least for this, was, population density and mm-hmm. then, multi-generational homes. Okay. So you have, certain populations where they have elderly people living with youngers, and definitely in the area that I work in, we saw certain populations where they have that have outbreaks in their communities, and a lot more deaths because, you know, the kids are going out and they're shopping, they're going to work if they're being allowed to, and then they come home and they might have a mild case, but we know that being in close proximity for extended period of time is probably the greatest predictor of spreading COVID to other people. And so they would infect their family members. And the thing with New York is that they're packed on top of each other. And the areas where people are packed on top of each other were the places that you saw the really big outbreaks. And, you know, it doesn't take a high percentage of 20 million people to really overwhelm a healthcare system, particularly in a place like New York, where the regulation, right. the regulatory mm-hmm. state that's preventing them from building new hospitals really means that they're going to be under, they're not going to have enough beds for right. something I mean, like they, this.
That's yeah, exactly what I was talking about to Bird about, a year ago. I was like, you got, like, according to statistics that I was looking up, they basically run at 90% capacity there 24/7, 365, which is doesn't leave a whole lot of room for error, you know?
Yeah, our hospital definitely did. And then we saw this massive drop. Like our volumes in the emergency department dropped by half easy. And
during lockdowns?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
it was a surreal time to work because you were just like, you weren't busy, and you were sitting around just waiting for the next patient to come in. And then every right. once in a while, a really sick patient with COVID would come in, and then right. everyone's on full alert, with that.
That had to be so bizarre.
It was weird. It was one of the more surreal times. The only other example that I can think of was during, when they were prepping everyone for the massive Ebola outbreak that never came.
Yeah. Was that 2013 or 14 or something?
I don't, somewhere around that.
I remember I was in Denver for that. I remember I was in Denver because somebody on their apartment building had put this huge sheet and hung it out on their balcony when you were coming back from skiing on 70. And it just said Ebola is here with a skull and crossbones, like spray painted on a white sheet. And it was just so ridiculous. Like nobody gave a shit. Like, it was just, what are you doing? And actually to echo what you were saying was, you know, here I at that time, and I'm an idiot for doing it. I know that to all the hardcore anarchists listening, but I was going to city council and making myself heard, even though I knew it didn't matter. But I was just so frustrated, and we were under lockdown. And I badgered, well, and you know, obviously they probably didn't do it because of me, but I was badgering them to put up statistics about the hospital, about the hospitals, because that was a big thing back in March and April, was like, oh, our hospitals are overrun, you know, and they put it up, and when they put the stats up, it was like at 80%, 75-80%. And then as they went under lockdown, we dipped below 45% full. And it got to the point, and I was showing up at the county or the city, I can't remember where I was going, but, and I was like pointing this out, and then they eventually pulled the data from pre, you know, COVID. So it
didn't look as bad. That sounds right.
Yeah. And it was totally absurd, you know, and they were dipping
the volleyball spreadsheet all over again.
Yeah, right, exactly. I'm always locked in this struggle for data between me and some bureaucratic entity.
The iron law of bureaucracy.
Yeah, exactly. Just screwing me. Like, just giving me a bad seating in the playoffs and also, like, keeping me from my job. So it dipped. It dipped so low. And like I said, I had friends who were nurses. My cousin is a doctor, but she doesn't live here. She's up north, and so my only friends in the medical industry down here are nurses. And I actually, like I said, I had one that got laid off or essentially got his hours cut to the point where he had to quit and get a different job. And it was just, I have to imagine that was bizarre for y'all because it was so quiet. But maybe the ventilators were full at the time because we were still, I don't know, but
yeah. Yeah. The numbers that were important at the time were your, ICU,
right,
bed availability, and uh-huh. And hospitals are notorious for not providing data because they're not required to, like mm-hmm. No one they don't have to tell you how much anything's going to cost in most places, and they don't have to like tell you how many beds are available. Some of them have started to show like wait times for the emergency department, but that's a new thing and a lot of hospitals don't do that, so you know, they're not incentivized to provide you with that bit of information. So we were seeing when we had our peak, which didn't happen initially, like we had a little one and then we were kind of flat. And then our first real peak was in the fall.
Tell me what you mean by peak.
We started seeing a bunch of patients. Our peaks for patients, people coming in, testing positive, and having to get admitted to the hospital. At one point, our hospital, about probably a sixth of our beds were COVID patients.
Damn. Okay. All
right. Yeah. Yeah. So when it was bad, it was like it was filling up a bunch of hospital beds.
That was like back like last like September, October, November ish, something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's when we saw our peak in California.
I think that was the same here.
But that's when it was bad. And, you know, if there had been other things going on, then potentially the hospital could have been overrun. But, you know, the lie that was told about flattening the curve globally, or maybe it wasn't even a lie. I'll give the benefit of the doubt to the public health people that were making these statements because, you know, they had no idea what they were dealing with either. So they were looking at New York and Italy and being really concerned, but the way it turned into any peak is a reason for a lockdown was right. The disingenuous side. Cause it's like you open up a bit and then more people get COVID. It's like, well, yeah. Like, are you a scientist or not? You know, if more people are going out, then more people are going to get a respiratory infection. This is a no-brainer. But using that as an excuse to then return to lockdowns and things like that was the thing where you really realize that there's an incentive problem with public health, where the incentive is to be overly aggressive, because if you're aggressive and a bunch of people get sick, then, oh, it's really good that I did that because more people would have gotten sick. And then if you're aggressive and no one gets sick, then you're like, well, thank goodness we were aggressive because no one got sick. Right.
Right.
But if you don't do anything and a bunch of people get sick, then you're like, well, if you had done something, then all these people wouldn't have died and that blood's on your hands. So
yeah, exactly.
It's a,
And the most frustrating part about that to me, and I understand that incentive loop, like that sucks. That's just like what you get in any kind of government system where it's like, if people die on a highway, it's like, well, you didn't give enough traffic tickets. But if we had some kind of balance, and I'm not advocating for police here, but I'm just saying, like, in this, in that scenario, it's like, what if the police were given bonuses for the number of people that got to work in a record amount of time or whatever? It's like, and that counterbalanced the amount of tickets they gave, but just something on the other side. Like, otherwise it's just, let's just put the gas pedal to the metal and just, and lock down without anything counterbalancing it. But what was frustrating to me was that they seem to pick, or at least the news. I when I say they, I don't want to conflate, physicians or whatever, like you and the news or whatever, because obviously they're bloodthirsty. It seemed like they were taking the worst statistic that they possibly could every day, whether that be infections, deaths, or hospitalizations, and they were just pumping it. And what I always thought was, you know, and this was me and my naivete before I realized how political this was going to get, was I was like, dude, having a shitload of infections is great if we don't have a whole lot of hospitalizations. What we should do is incentivize every 40-year-old and under to go out and just drink beer together all in one night and just get them out of the way and just, and get that immunity. I mean, obviously that's a rough around the edges way to put it, but you know what I mean? Like it seemed to me like getting a bunch of infections from relatively healthy people that can ride the storm out of the way would be a great way to approach this so that we didn't have to deal with this ongoing, like pulling the, you know, like, oh, you can go out to restaurants from 2 to 6 and then, oh no, we've got to bring it back. You know, it just always seemed like very disjointed in its effort.
COVID goes to sleep at night.
Yes. Right. Exactly. Yes. It goes to sleep at night. It goes to sleep. It doesn't live above below 6 feet in the air when you sit down at the restaurants. And
yes, if you sit down, then you're fine.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. No, you're spot. I mean, Sweden did that, right? Sweden said, you know, let's try to keep it out of the nursing homes.
Yeah.
And then outside of that, you have to make your own risk benefit assessment. Like, is the risk of going to work worth the benefit? And you know, that depended on a certain degree of communal insight, and then also a bit of understanding on the side of the bosses that are managing these people to be like, okay, if you live in a home with a 90-year-old, I get it. Let's make it so you can work from home, because you going out and getting exposed puts your 90-year-old grandparent at risk. But if you're living alone and you're 25, I mean, your risk is as close to zero. Like, you're probably higher risk walking to work to get hit by a car than you are from dying of COVID. So we've lost this idea that life is about risks and that everything has a risk benefit analysis associated with it, including the vaccines. I think on both sides of this argument, of the vaccine argument, I've seen like a complete ignoring of the idea of a risk benefit analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm interested in both your and Lee's reasoning for what went into your decision making against getting a COVID shot of any kind at this point. I'm just interested in it because, like, I don't think you necessarily made the wrong choice. For me, I decided to get it because I'm exposed at work all the time. And I can't really trying to find someone to work for me for 2 weeks while I recover from COVID would have been more of a hassle than the risks of getting the vaccine for me personally. But I know that it's a personal decision for everyone, especially young, healthy people. And so I'm always interested in people's reasons.
Sure. I'll go first since mine's relatively simple. Lee's life is a lot more. I'm single. I don't have a family. I'm 33 and I'm in, I haven't been to the doctor in probably 15 years, but I go out and play beach volleyball pretty much every day. And I, lift weights. Like I'm in, you know, if something's going to take me down, God meant it to take me down is kind of my, my mentality. And probably some of that is a little bit of careless, male ego. But I, you know, I don't think I've gotten a shot since I had to get him to go to college, of any kind. I haven't been to the doctor. I've had to go to get a knee surgery. And I had to get an x-ray on something cause I fucked something up one time. I don't remember. Oh, it was my knee again. But I just don't, I mean, if something's going to take me, it's going to take me. I will have to revisit that mentality when I have a family, but I mean, I'm super active and in pretty good health. So I'll leave it. That was just my reasoning. I would prefer to get COVID, to be completely honest with you. I'll let Lee take it.
Yeah. I mean, my thinking on it, there's a couple factors. One is that just kind of as a rule of thumb, it didn't seem like a great idea, to get the first round of anything, you know, especially when, you know, like, you know, to go back to your point about risk versus reward, you know, I'm also in a demographic that has a relatively low risk of mortality, from it. I mean, I'm 35. So if the choice is between like, okay, well, you could risk a COVID infection and potentially, you know, deal with illness from that with a relatively low risk of mortality, you know, or you could get a vaccine that is new and there's no known like long-term, you know, consequences, side effects, outcomes. Again, with, you know, some risk of illness from that. And again, like a very small risk of mortality. It was just one of those things where like it didn't, you know, the benefit does not seem to outweigh the risk from just a, I guess like just a gut trusting standpoint. Like if you take the idea that there's always free cheese in a mousetrap, that's kind of the situation. I mean, this is the, you know, the vaccine is being provided. There's all these, you know, pharmaceutical companies that don't have much credibility. You know, I mean, these companies aren't offering this stuff out of the goodness of their heart. Pfizer has a long track record of ethical violations, and, you know, like, you know, being ruled against in criminal cases. So, I mean, I don't trust the source. Like, I don't trust the manufacturer. I don't trust the information around it that I'm seeing on the news. And I see conflicting, you know, information about efficacy and risk simply because this is a brand new thing, and it doesn't seem, you know, worth it basically to take the risk. You know, I mean, I have a family, you know, young kids at home, you know, and you read stuff, whether it's true or not, you know, about, you know, shedding, you know, viral load, effects on fertility, you know, things like that, infant mortality rates. I've got a newborn at home, with, you know, in terms of like breastfeeding, like my wife breastfeeds. So, you know, there's just a lot of, information to sort out, none of it from sources that I, you know, would consider credible. And so it just doesn't seem worth it taking risks, for something that, you know, is not to prevent something that is also not that risky. That was, you know, kind of my reasoning on it. Yeah. Like it makes perfect sense to me that like, you know, the older population, like I don't have, you know, I don't think it's necessarily like just a bad idea to like get the vaccine. It's just, for me, it didn't seem like the way to go.
Yeah. And that, I mean, like I wish that every person went through the risk benefit analysis that you did, instead of falling back on the, like the current tribal views of these various vaccines. I mean, even calling it a vaccine triggers some of the more, special people in our, in the libertarian community. Yeah.
Which is so frustrating.
Well, it seems
it's very frustrating.
Right. Like I don't, you know, like, and I'm not, you know, I'm not anti-vaccine. Like, you know, my kids are vaccinated, you know, we go to the doctor, you know, that kind of thing. Like, you know, kidding aside, I'm not, you know, like an anti-vaxxer, like an extremist with this stuff. You know, we are fortunate to live in America and have access to, you know, much of what modern medicine has to offer. You know, this just seemed like something that was, it really also turned me off to it, that it was hyper political. You know what I mean? Like there's not a huge political debate, about like the measles vaccine, because it's been around forever. And that's not like a hyper effective vaccine. I mean, measles is basically eradicated, but, that's only like an 88% efficacy, if I remember right. For something that is also rarely fatal, but it's been around forever and it's not presented in like a, you know, politically contested manner. And there's not a lot of conflicting information about it. So like, you know, that makes perfect sense. But just in this case, it doesn't hold up to, for me.
I think that if the flu vaccine had, you know, were just an overwhelming success every year, then it may have it probably wouldn't have affected me because I've never gotten the flu vaccine anyway, but man, to my knowledge, I've never really had the flu or never like had, like a horrible flu like experience or anything like that. I don't think, or at least not recently. But I mean, you know, and I guess part of it too is like, I work from home. Like if I'm sick, it's not the end of the world for me and I'm not super exposed to people and whatever. But like the big thing for me was like, A, yeah, it was super political around it. B, the effects of actually getting COVID for me were probably, I you know, odds are I wasn't even going to notice it if I had it. I may have had it. And then C, it's like, well, the flu vaccine sucks. So why is this going to be any better? You know?
Yeah. I mean, in my, you know, non-medical opinion, I in a lot of ways view this as analogous to a flu vaccine. Obviously, you know, Stateless Med would be the one to speak to that. But especially all this stuff with, you know, the Delta variant and the Epsilon and the, what, you know, whatever, the Lima, you know, all these things Lambda.
Ligma.
Right. Ligma. Yeah. Ligma, Bofa.
Yeah.
The Bofa variant. Yeah. The Bofa, Taganma. These are all right around the corner.
They're just getting, the variants are getting more and more aggressive.
That's when you got to get really worried. That's when everyone needs to get vaccinated.
That's when I'll get the vaccine.
Right.
I mean, if the Ligma variant comes knocking on my door, man, I'm getting vaccinated.
You need to wear a mask.
I think you're spot on in your assessment of that, because if I was not working in the field that I was working and not worried particularly about like honestly I was more worried about the 2 to 3 weeks that I would have to like inconvenience my coworkers than I was about COVID. And you know, I'm young and healthy, so me going to work, getting exposed puts me myself at very little risk. But I work with some people that are older and in higher risk categories, and they're still seeing patients. And so, like, that's one of the things that went into my decision making was to be like, well, I can look at the original studies and look at the risk of getting it and realize that the risk of getting the vaccine is low and the risk of getting COVID is low. And so then the other parts come into my decision making. And so I was like, well, if I get sick, then that means that these other people that are at higher risk, that have kids, that have other reasons why I wouldn't want them to be exposing themselves, they're going to have to work for me. For sure. And there's also people, I think one of the things that people don't necessarily think about in their decision making for this is like, can you afford 2 weeks off work?
Right.
Like do you have a job where if you get COVID, you can be at home and you'll be fine. There's plenty of people that can't, like if they get COVID, they either lose their job or they could not be able to pay their mortgage or pay other things. And I think that part of the decision-making gets lost a little bit when you hear some of the more dogmatic members of our communities, like talking about, like, I can't understand why any any of these sheep would get the COVID vaccine. It's like, well, there's more than just the risk of COVID that goes into it. That being said, I think that the push to vaccinate kids is gross. Like, personally, yeah. I think that we don't have enough long-term data, like Lee was saying, on these, on this form of vaccine, even though there are other treatments using mRNA, but this is the first vaccine using this technology. And you're going to expose kids to it. And this is kind of the first time that I've seen this in the medical community. Usually it takes forever to get an adult treatment approved for kids.
Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong. This is still, are any of these like FDA approved under normal guidelines, or is this all still under an emergency use authorization?
It's still under emergency use. There's rumors that there's going to be a full approval imminently coming, which is also a bit weird because typically, at least in the past, there's needed to be for these new technologies like an 18-month post dosing period to look for adverse events. But I think a lot of that, there's been tons of things that, like, tons of regulations that should have gone out the window, and then other ones that are a bit surprising. But I'm in favor of using emergency use for the vaccines. I just think that they need to do a better job of explaining to people that it's still experimental, because right now they're saying like effective and safe, and you can't necessarily say that from a technical standpoint. Like, we don't know what the long-term effects of these, is it high risk? Probably not, but I mean, we just don't know
at this point. Right. I mean, go ahead, Carr.
Go ahead.
No, you. I look at it, because I'm, a layman, the only thing that I can, use to scrutinize this kind of stuff is questioning incentives. So I don't know, maybe you can speak to this. Maybe I'm just off the reservation here, but like the push to vaccinate kids, 18, 12, that kind of thing. I haven't seen this before. Like I said, I'm 35. So I haven't seen it in my life. But my understanding is that kids really are practically, statistically unaffected by this. Like, there's, with a handful of exceptions, I think there's only, there's basically like no mortality rate for
less than 300 deaths in kids.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, I think it's a little more dangerous for like under one, right? But once toddlers all the way up to like teenagers, unless you're really obese or in poor health, generally, then this has no real risk of mortality or serious outcomes, as far as I know. So when I see that there's a very large concerted push in a very atypical fashion to provide kids with a product that has no cost associated to the consumer, that makes me very skeptical of like the incentives that are involved. And it makes me feel like there's something going on that I don't know about that may or may not be nefarious. How is this breaking down by the money? Do you have any insight into that?
Oh, I mean, the federal government has given billions of dollars to all the manufacturers. They, like, the first round of vaccines was essentially all funded ahead of time.
Right.
So like the federal government prepaid Pfizer and Moderna and a couple of other companies to manufacture these with the understanding that the only way you get these really quickly is if you pump a bunch of money into them.
Sure.
So I understand that aspect of it. Like, do I think that the individual companies should have paid for it themselves? Absolutely. And then they can charge for it. And people, like, that would add an additional piece of information into the cost benefit analysis of deciding whether to get a vaccine.
I mean, specifically in terms of, shots in arms. Like, if you're Pfizer and you get paid to make 100 million vaccines, and you deliver 100 million vaccines to a government warehouse or wherever it goes, You know, and then your check clears. Like if I'm the CEO of Pfizer, you know, hey, look, those aren't my vaccines anymore. You can set them on fire, flush them down the drain. I don't care. You know, I made the product. You gave me the money. I'm done. It's not important to me that there's a huge risk of compliance from the end user. Like, why is this so important for, you know, like you've got Xavier Becerra coming out today saying that it is the government's business who has not been vaccinated, sending people door to door with, you know, quote, strike teams or whatever. You know, I mean, I know that the odds are that's going to be like some 17-year-old kid who still believes in civics from like the high school model UN. It's not like a paranoid black helicopters thing. But like, why is this so important in terms of like young people? Like, why I don't understand the incentive for the government to force an experimental vaccine onto a demographic that basically has no risk associated with what it's, you know, preventing.
Yeah. I mean, I wish I had better insight into it. I like just purely speculating. I think that
tell us, we demand an answer, Stainless Med. Yeah. This is why
I'm afraid that you have not paid me enough money to show up on the show.
Yeah, we haven't. We haven't paid the money up front.
I don't have the documents. but I think what happened, like very early on, like if you remember back to the early days, it was always about like we need herd immunity, including vaccination, and then we can go back to normal, right?
Yeah.
And it just got stuck in everyone's head. And I don't think that even the propagandists are like immune to their own propaganda. Yeah. I think these people truly do, like being generous, I think they truly do believe that the only way to prevent the next horrible variant that's gonna not be prevented by these different vaccines is to get rid of any possible infection pool. But that's because the goal line was always set to this insanely impossible like level. Once COVID got worldwide, it's one of those viruses, it's going to be around. We're going to have COVID season. Odds are we're going to have COVID season, just like we have flu season. And so there's going to be a yearly COVID shot. And unless like you're not going to be able to eradicate it around the world, which means you're going to have your little populations that get a new variant. It's going to spread with international travel, and that's just going to be the nature of it. But they're going to try to blame unvaccinated people for those variants, even though like the U.S. is one of the highest vaccinated countries in the world. So trying to blame it on the U.S. and not say it's coming from any other country that has a 20% vaccination rate is just disingenuous. But they're using it to try to scare people. And I think that there's a genuine fear in some of the people that are pushing it. But I also think that there's a control aspect where they view it's like the Cartman respect my authority. And they get pissed when people are just like not listening to what they tell them to do. Even if they can't support what they want you to do with data, they're gonna get mad when you say no.
I'm almost okay with that. I mean, I don't like it, but that's the better reason than some more dark reason for everybody to get it. You know, I mean.
There's just too many people involved. Like, it's one of those things that, you know, like a good conspiracy theory has to have just enough people to be successful, but not too many. Yeah. So as everyone finds out about it, right? And there's too many companies that are producing these things. There's too much money going around, too many people involved for it to be like at least the vaccine side, for it to be like a real conspiracy. I really do think that most of the people pushing it are doing it because they genuinely think it's the right thing to do. Part of that's just because they're ignorant as to the data, and they've been convinced that like the goalposts are a certain place, but they put them so far beyond what we can successfully do that like we're always going to be chasing it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think I, you know, and this is one of those things that, you know, if you ask, you know, one of your liberal friends, like, how many people die by assault rifle every year, you know, and they'll have just some wildly insane number. I think that you ask something like a COVID statistic from most people, and they'll just have a wildly insane number because I mean, not from any real fault of their own. It's been the topic of conversation for a year and a half, and any topic of conversation for a year and a half must be of epic proportions. And no doubt it is quite damaging to certain aspects of the population, but you know, in much the same way, I think, you know, you just get so transfixed, by the daily news, and you lose sight, forest through the trees type thing. We've been going for an hour. I still have a couple things that do you guys have time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Do we mind if we shift towards like the variants and kind of going forward?
Yeah, sure. That sounds good.
Okay. I'm very curious about this. I'm very curious about, hearing about what's going on the ground. What is the, like, I have a vague concept, as a lowly civil engineer, of the fact that like viruses exist and they change like to some degree over time. And that can create like flu seasons. Like you can get the flu 1 year and have immunity for the rest of the year, but then maybe it changes slightly and your body doesn't know how to fight it, yada, yada, yada. But what is like the view on the ground from all these variants? Because they're starting to talk about, you know, for example, the Delta or Lambda or what have you. And, I don't even know what question to properly ask, but Stateless Med, do you think you could just speak on it for a little bit?
Sure. So, you know, any of these types of viruses, they mutate over time. They're mRNA viruses, so they use messenger RNA, which is pretty prone to like to when they're being copied to errors in the process. And every once in a while, one of those errors produces a viable viral particle. And sometimes that viral particle is more infectious. Sometimes that viral particle is more deadly. Very, very rarely it's both. It's pretty uncommon that like a highly infectious variant is going to be more deadly than the base variant. Not saying that it can't happen, but it's pretty uncommon. Usually these things mutate in a way to become more infectious but less deadly so they can spread. It's just one of those natural things that happens with mm-hmm. both flu and coronaviruses. As an example, you know, the common cold is one of the things that causes it is a coronavirus, like a very mild coronavirus, and it goes around and only highly immunocompromised people are at any risk from it. But it's one of those coronaviruses that's mutated to be highly infectious, but not deadly at all. And so it survives really well in communities by spreading that way. So anytime you have any of these viruses moving through communities, you're going to see variants, and it's going to be a constantly moving target, which is why it was relatively surprising and kind of lucky that the mRNA technology works the way it does. I think that like what I wish had happened would be that the manufacturers were forced to publish what mRNA sequence they're using, because that's currently patent protected. So not only do they get protection of what mRNA sequence they're using, but they also get protection against being sued, which like how you get both is quite the like quite the coup.
Yeah, quite the conundrum there.
Yeah. But if they publish that, then the moment a new variant popped up, you would be able to know like, okay, how different is the spike protein, which is usually the target. It's this protein on the outside of the virus that binds and allows it to enter cells. And that's what the vaccines produce, a variant of the spike protein so that you produce antibodies to it. So if you knew what portion of the spike protein was being produced by the mRNA, then you'd be able to tell, okay, there's no change in this sequence, so the vaccine should still work. But they, and that work could be done really quickly because these these variants are being sequenced like within days of being identified. Mm-hmm. Like the technology is amazing that they can do this. And if they found a variant that had a mutation of the spike protein that was so severe that it was still infecting people, but was no longer targeted by the vaccine, then they could produce a new, like a new vaccine. Using the mRNA technology, they, within 48 hours, they can start producing the next version. And I think that's going to be the future. Don't be surprised about booster shots and things like that. Anyone who pretended like it was going to be a one and done shot was lying. Like this was never going to be a one and done shot. This was always going to be as mutations happen, depending on what version of the vaccine people got, they're going to need a booster for the new version that's going around. And like they were being disingenuous that that was never going to be the case. Like the, I don't know. It was this idea of zero COVID that people were trying to sell that was just never going to be a reality once it got worldwide. And it turned out to be one of those viruses that can spread really easy before people get super sick.
So
go ahead, Lee.
So from a financial standpoint, obviously there's an incentive for this information to stay proprietary. But it sounds like from an ethical standpoint, I mean, this is a pretty good reason to adopt like an open source kind of mentality, right?
Oh yeah, 100%. In my mind, there should be one of two options for this type of thing. You either get to keep your patent secret or you don't have to publish what sequence you're using, or you get immunity, right? It's one or the other. You don't get both.
Right.
So if you want immunity from being sued or to use the vaccine injury money pool, then you publish all the information about your vaccine and anyone can make it. If you don't want to do that, then fine. You open yourself up to liability if you injure people. Like, I think that's a reasonable way to approach this. That would put incentives in the right place.
Yeah, I mean that sounds fair to me.
Yeah, seems reasonable. Yeah. Has there been what is the word on the street with regards to, you know, we were talking about this idea of zero COVID, which is obviously somewhere along the way that got adopted, whether it's explicit or implicit. Basically, anybody that's coming on the TV is talking from a standpoint of zero COVID. I guess what I kind of want to understand is, do you have any insight from your side of the table on, and I know this sounds like almost like a dumb question, but when is this over? Like when does this go from being COVID to being the flu? You know, I mean, when does this, we have enough vaccines out there. Everybody's got the vaccines that we want. There's a few enough people in the hospital. When does that happen?
I think it happens when enough people are willing to inform themselves about it. Okay. And I think that, like I've heard you talk about before, that this is just going to turn into a regional thing. Like I have very little hope that California is not going to lock down again this fall.
God,
I think it's going to happen because it'll be after Gavin Newsom's recall election, assuming that Caitlyn Jenner doesn't win and kick him out of office, which would be just amazing. For California.
Isn't she running as a Republican or he or
yeah or whatever? Yeah, yeah, that's running as a Republican. She can go in the follow the footsteps of Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Arnie, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, the governator.
Yep.
But I just don't, I think too many people have become too invested in it. Right. Like so many people became so invested in the virtue signaling that was associated with doing your part. Right. I haven't gone out of the house in 6 months. You're like, cool. You've ordered DoorDash. So you've allowed someone else to do it for you. So that's awesome. I'm so proud of your sacrifice. So many of those people have become invested in this idea that I think they're just going to put up with whatever it is and do what they're told. Which if you had told me this beginning of January, when I was convinced that we were going to go to war with Iran,
forgot about that shit, dude.
Yeah. After the Carpocalypse happened.
After Carpocalypse, yeah. Or Carmageddon, I think it was.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. What a strange turn of events. Jesus.
Yeah. I never would have believed it, but we've done it now. And you know that there's enough people that are willing to follow through on it. I mean, I go to the grocery store and we don't have to wear masks anymore. It says if you're vaccinated, you don't have to wear a mask in the grocery store. And I go in there and at least 3/4 of the people are still wearing masks. And I know that in the population going to the stores near where I live, that most people are vaccinated. So like they've accepted this as the new reality. And it's going to be really hard to force them out of it. Maybe the end of, if they actually end some of these, like paying people not to work and preventing evictions, maybe people will be like some sense will get knocked into them, about the actual costs of all the stuff they were willing to do. But I don't have a whole lot of hope for it. I'm a little pessimistic from that standpoint. I mean, I'll keep living my life, but I mean, I'm lucky enough to work in a field where like none of this, like it affects me, but like in the grand scheme, it doesn't really affect me. Like I still get to go to work. I still get paid. I still get like all my benefits. So like it's all those other people that lost their jobs or lost their benefits and were willing to do it because they were told it was the right thing to do. And it's like, well, how many times do you do that to people before they stop? And I just don't know.
Yeah. It's certainly going to break down it certainly seems like it's going to break down into some, regional divisions, I guess. And like you were saying, I mean, I don't know, man, it's just very difficult to tell because like there's people around here, you know, the prevailing feeling, and I'm sure Lee would agree in his, we're both in Gomez, it's largely like, I haven't even thought about a mask in terms of day-to-day life in months, and Lee probably for longer.
It's been quite a minute.
But you talk to people that are from, you know, I have friends like back from the East Coast that live in like in the Northeast and stuff like that. And, it's like they're living a year behind us, and it's really, really strange. And there are some people that are so, so damn committed at this point that I don't see a clean way out for a lot of people. I don't see a clean way out, and that's kind of concerning. I realize that we're kind of straying away from maybe the original intent of this, but I'm just not sure how we I asked you earlier, when are we done with COVID? I guess what I'm not seeing is, and I'm not asking anybody for a definitive answer on this, because I don't think anybody knows, but it's like, when is this over? When are people done with COVID? When is it that it is not part of our day-to-day life, it's not part of our culture? That's like, it's okay, it's in the past. Because like, if you look back at like the, whatever it is, Spanish flu of 1919, well, I know it's speaking of extremes, but I didn't even know of the Spanish flu of 1919 until COVID came around. We look back in history. At some point that just ceased to be a part of history, or a part of day-to-day life. Like, when does that happen for this? And I'm just struggling because I don't really understand what metrics have to be hit. I don't know if there aren't any. Yeah. Right. Maybe.
Right. It's a moving target. It started as 2 weeks to flatten the curve, right, and slow the spread. And then it was, we got to stay indoors, do your part. And then it was just until the vaccines get here. And now everyone that really wants a vaccine has gotten it. And it really shows you how disingenuous, or at least the lack of understanding of the actual effectiveness of these vaccines, the way that people are responding to it, because they actually work really, really well, like surprisingly well. And that's like the post data suggests that too. So all the people that got it after the initial trials, it's like, these seem to work really well. So, you know, you should feel incredibly comfortable going about your daily life, because the likelihood of you running into someone with COVID is already pretty low. And then if you add to that the protection that the vaccine's giving you, then your risk of getting it is small enough that you don't have to worry about it. But I, like, people just, like, it became politicized, and that's when you knew that it was going to last.
Right? Yeah. You're right. You're right. I don't know what the, I know we don't have them. I just don't know what the metrics are. I don't know what those things are that we have to hit. And I know I'm not saying like, oh, we've got to get to 4% or 3%. I'm not naive enough to think that it has anything to do with the actual numbers of cases. I'm just wondering, like, is it another election? Is it, a military invasion from someone else that we just takes our mind off of it?
Maybe a financial crisis,
maybe hyperinflation.
Yeah. I mean, it has to be something that removes the attention. Because like time and time again, the U.S. population has been shown to have a very short attention span when some new shiny thing pops up.
Right. Which could work in our favor in this case, I guess.
Yeah. 100%.
So, okay. Well, I we've been going on for a long time. Do we have any, I know that I hogged a little bit of the spotlight here. So do we have any additional questions, anything else that we want to hash out? Anything else before we wrap this puppy up?
I think I'm good.
Stateless Men. It's been great.
Well, I appreciate you both for coming on. Stateless Men, particularly, this is the first time that we've done a podcast together. And like I said, a million thanks for all of your input through the early days of COVID, and particularly for coming on this episode. This was great. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Lee, I've been a fan since the original beefs with Robbie the Fire.
Oh shit. Okay. All right. Old hell yeah. Well, great, man. Well, it's great to finally get you on one of these, and maybe we can get you on the TLE show too, and shoot the shit. Plugs, Stateless Med. I know you probably don't want to give too much, but at least follow you on Twitter at Stateless Med, and anything else?
Nope, that's it.
Okay, Lee, your usual.
Yeah, just you can find me on Twitter at Enfield, ENPHIELD.
Cool. All right, guys. Well, thanks a million. And until next month, eskeet it.